talk a little bit about what we've covered so far since we're winding down 1 Peter. So I'm going to back up just a little bit. This is how we began. Actually, that's how we began, with this idea that Peter's writing this letter to Christians who are scattered all over the Asia Minor area. And here are a few things that we picked up early in the lesson, just a quick five-minute catch-up. Written by Peter, probably mid-60s. This is around the time that Nero is ramping up his persecution against Christians. And many believe that that's about to move its way to the east and affect Christians in a very profound way. So as we've said, in just about every class, they've been outcast by their Jewish brethren from the south, and now they're looking at some pretty heavy hitting from the west. So it's a theme in this letter, and it's really undeniable, this idea of suffering and how to handle it, how to mentally prepare, how to actually prepare, is just a theme that permeates just about every chapter, and we really could have chosen more verses than that. So the introduction is, there's a world of trial and tribulation coming your way, and that leads us into chapter 1. And so don't worry too much about what's in the middle, since we can't cover all of it today, but down at the bottom we've tried to sum it up. You are saved, so live courageously. You're born to a living hope. You have incredible confidence. Let's get ready. Let's fight this. Remember, we are children of God. We are His people. We are unique to all of the people upon this earth. And unfortunately, that uniqueness was drawing attention. That uniqueness would cause God's people to be noticed and to get targeted. So what do we do about that? We do what we can. We continue to worship God and be holy, and we try to be the example that the world needs to see. It's an incredible idea to think I'm going to be treated differently and worse because I'm a Christian, and I will use that opportunity to show the world what they need to see. Now, that took us into chapter 3, and we'd been looking at relationships all through chapter 2. In your relationship with the world, here's how you need to behave. In your relationship with the government, here's the attitude that you need to have, masters and slaves. And then in chapter 3, in marriage. And by the way, remember how there were 6 verses dedicated to the ladies and only 1 verse dedicated to the men? Boy, the emails I got about that. I didn't write the stuff. That's about to turn around on you in chapter 5, gentlemen, so get ready for that. The predominant structure of chapter 5 is for the men. But here there's a lot for the ladies dealing with ungodly husbands and maybe husbands, ungodly wives. But in all relationships, in verse 8, to sum up, let all of you be. All relationships, and we looked at these 6 things right here. Now, we led our way into where we've been, and this is our last probably week and a half worth of study. We've been in chapter 4. You have to arm yourself. Just knowing that you are saved and knowing that we're supposed to be different from the world is not enough to cause us to behave like saved people and stand up for what is right in the world. Does that make sense? You can know you're a Christian, you can believe it, and you can understand who you're supposed to be, but that is not enough. So we have to make some preparations. We need to be ready for this fight, and that's something that ought to strike very close to home for people in times of peace like you and me. So number 1, we got to get rid of junk that doesn't belong. The time already passed is sufficient for worldly behavior, for immoral behavior, for lack of sobriety, lack of self-control. That stuff tears you down and makes you susceptible to the devil. You're going to see that in chapter 5, the prowling, roaring lion. We want to prepare. So first thing we got to do is we got to get rid of stuff that doesn't belong. Second thing we need to do is we need to strengthen our position through good works. Hospitality. Love for the brethren. Service of one another. It's not just something good you do. It actually makes you stronger. It makes you more spiritual. It builds your support system. It changes things. So if we really want to stand when times get tough, there's some things that just have got to go, and there's some things that need to be flourishing through our behavior. And then lastly, and this is where we were this last week, let's not be surprised. It's like a soldier who prepares for war. He slims down. He works on his physical skills. He runs miles to make sure he's ready for the traction of the terrain ahead. He trains with his weaponry. He learns about his squadron. He goes over there and he's in a place of peace, but they're totally prepared. And the first time an adversary shows up, he's completely shocked and surprised and he runs the other direction. That's not the way it's supposed to work. The preparation is supposed to get us ready for the confrontation. So do not be surprised. Keep on rejoicing. This is what we've been training for. You are blessed. The Spirit of God rests. We talked about that last time. Love that verse. Rests on you. We're going to glorify God in this name. Soldiers serving our Savior. And the outcome is where we finished last time. What's the outcome of all of this? Just to get everybody involved this morning. What's the outcome? I know, I talked too much. I knew it. I knew I went 30 seconds too long and I shut the group down. I apologize. I'll open with a question next time. If we really put in the labor here and we get the sin out and we get the good in and we stop being so shocked when people don't like Christianity around us, what's the outcome? Initial outcome is we become more like Christ. What's a longer term outcome?
Crown of life.
When you die. We were at the colonial facility this morning, sitting in a room with people who are much closer probably to that than some of the others who were there. We had some little kids running around today. Hopefully they're nowhere near that. But those who are close to that, there comes a point when you got to lay that armor down. You lay the sword down, you lay the armor down, you shed the entire thing you've built, and you just give your soul over to God. And you're powerless. You're powerless to fight the devil. You're powerless to argue for your salvation. You can't get rid of anything bad, verses 1 through 6. And you can't add anything good. You just shed what you have and you hand your soul over to the Lord. In fact, maybe better language is, He's going to take it. And from that point, what happens for eternity is set before God. Why do I stick with this? Because one day I have to hand my soul over to the Lord and He will do with it what I have demanded that He do with it through our choices. What will be the outcome? Do not be surprised. So that leads us up to the new material that we will be covering today. But let me open it up to you in case there's just a burning question that needs to be asked or a comment that needs to be made. Do you have anything lingering on from chapter 4 that you'd like to share with us? Chapter 4, not be surprised. All right. Take a look at the 5th chapter. I'm not going to argue this morning that the entirety of the chapter, except for the last sort of salutations at the end, the concluding remarks, I'm not going to argue that the entire chapter is just to men. I don't think I can substantiate that, but it's possible. It's possible that just about everything you're about to see in chapter 5 are to the men of the families, the men of the church. So if the ladies are still thinking, I just can't let it go, that 6 verses were to wives and 1 to husbands, well, like I said, He's about to get His, because it's time to talk to men about how you can facilitate success. So I know we're going to be dealing with that in the first few verses. We're looking at shepherds, elders, bishops, leaders. And then I know we're going to be dealing with it in the next couple of verses, maybe more than a couple. I'll ask you about it with younger men, and then we'll finish up with the overall message. Somebody help us out with this. If we were going to just have a study this morning on elders, it's the most common term that we use, right? Elders. I'm not against that term. Some people hear me say shepherds, and they say, this guy not know that they're called elders? They have many different names. Depends on your version. We call them bishops if you want. You don't. Okay. If we were going to study elders, there are at least 4 places we're going in our Bible to help us study that. Where are we going? 1 Timothy 2 and 3, right? We're going to 1 Timothy 2 and mainly there in the first 7 verses of chapter 3. We're not going to do it this morning, but that's where you're going, 1 Timothy 3. What other New Testament passage would you say is very similar to 1 Timothy 3 where you'd also be? Titus chapter 1, right? 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1. Here's my follow-up question. Why would you go to those places? And I guess better question, what would you learn about elders in those 2 places? What do you think their primary purpose is? What do we mean? You're exactly right. What do we mean when we say we're going to Titus 1 and 1 Timothy 3 so that we can learn elder qualifications? What does that mean?
Type of man you're looking for.
Okay. This is the type of guy we're looking for. It reminds me of Acts 6 when they were going to choose. They said we need people full of the Spirit and wisdom. If they're not full of the Spirit and wisdom, they can't be selected. Well, when it comes to overseers of a local church, the list is a little bit longer, isn't it? So we have the Titus list, the Timothy list, and we typically study them together and we use one to help explain the other. And we come away with, here's the kind of man. Now, there is a little bit in those 2 passages about the actual work he will do. Most of it's about the type of man that he is, temperate, self-controlled, faithful to his wife, you know, this guy. Some of it is about the kind of guy going in. In those two places, what is there about the actual work that he will do once he is an elder? In Timothy and Titus only. What's there? There's a little bit.
Use those attributes.
How specific, Matt's right, how specifically, and I think Titus is the passage I'm leaning towards, how specifically would he use those attributes? You can look if you need to. Yes, sir.
There are mouths that have to be stopped in these places. There are false teachers that are out of control.
Yes.
And that is their work. That is their main work, defending the gospel and spirituality.
Exactly right. If I just had Titus and Timothy, I would say, here's who can be an elder, the qualifications, and we debate and discuss that at great length, but we all as a church agree with it and we move on. And when he gets in, his primary work in that text is when wolves come in amongst the sheep. That's the idea of shepherding. You are protectors of the sheep. So when wolves come in with false teaching and they need to be refuted, that's why an elder has to be apt to teach. Apt to teach, because sometimes you've got to show them biblically what's wrong. So those are great passages, and they stand on their own in that sense, qualification sense. Where else, other than 1 Peter 5, where else would you go to study elders? Except this time we move sort of past the first stage of qualifications and more into the stage of here is what they do. Where do we go?
Revelation.
Where are you going in Revelation? All right, John. That's interesting. All right, the attitude of John, that's good. Give me something. You got to be in Acts 20, don't you? You've got to be there. In Acts 20, the Apostle Paul's traveling through. He asks the elders of Ephesus to meet him in a little town of Miletus. He was kind of in a hurry. And he speaks to them in the latter half of Acts 20. And it's less about, here's the man who can be an elder. He's got to be self-controlled, not pugnacious. Look, he's already in a room with self-controlled, non-pugnacious guys. They're already elders. Now it's about, here is what you need to do. So can you remember, and you're welcome to look, Acts 20, what is some of the work of a local elder? Feed the flock. That's a really powerful term. Feed the flock. Yes, sir. All right.
He's got to be a good example of others, too.
Okay. All right, so example, you're going to see that in 1 Peter 5. An example to others, feeding the flock. One of the primary examples of an eldership in Acts 20 is understanding and exemplifying a very non-American concept. Anybody know what it is, Acts 20? A very non-Gen X idea. It is more blessed to give than to receive. In fact, I think that if I was going to preach on that today, that would be the title of the sermon. It's more blessed to give than receive. And an eldership sort of getting that and seeing how that lives and breathes and looks and acts is sort of what Acts 20 is about. Well, I would say, and there are other passages, but I would say that a study of eldership is going to involve at least four places. 1 Timothy and Titus, qualifications and refuting false teaching. Acts chapter 20, feeding the flock, helping the weak, giving of yourself. The fourth one would probably be right here. Look in 1 Peter chapter 5, except this time, unlike those other passages, we know a little bit about the context. So I'm going to read a familiar passage to you, these first few verses, no surprises. But when I ask you what this looks like or how they would have behaved or what difference they would have made, I want you to think about it from the perspective of what you know about the setting. What you know about the setting, right? You know that it's mid-60s AD. You know that the words suffer and reviled, I'm just looking in chapter 4, verse 12, fiery ordeals, 4, verse 13, sufferings of Christ, verse 14, reviled, verse 16, suffers, verse 19, suffers. Chapter 5, verse 9, suffering. Verse 10, suffered. And you could go through all five chapters. I know that they are in a place of great suffering because they are Christians. Not because they've done anything wrong, but because they've done something right. So when I read these verses and I ask you, okay, what's an elder's job? What does he do? I want you thinking about it and answering in terms of the value of shepherds over sheep when the sheep are under great duress, because that's your letter. That's what we're dealing with. Mr. Noble?
Say, this might be a little off what you're talking about, but the interesting thing about this information and requirements for an elder being revealed at this point in time, the church began in around AD 33. And right off, God gives you the stuff you need when you need it. Right off the bat, you have the plan of salvation and all of that revealed. But for about 20 years, the gospel was in the mouths of inspired men. It only began to be recorded unless James was revealed earlier, around 52 or 53 A.D. And so the Holy Spirit is preparing the church for the long haul. All of the New Testament, with the exception of James' writings, was revealed between 52 A.D. and 67 or 68 A.D. The destruction of Jerusalem was just 2 years, or 3 or 4 years at the most, down the road. So he's giving us these requirements for an elder. And he's setting the church up for the days when the apostles won't be there. It's not going to be very long, and they're not going to be any more apostles around. Okay.
So I don't disagree with where you're going. The application's there. It's not that I'm about to say, unless you're a church in persecution, you don't need 1 Peter 5. That's not what I'm going to say. Mr. Noble's right. The principles here set up the church forever. Until Christ returns, they're set up. But they were initially given during a time of immense distress. And I think we can use that. I think the point is, when you can capture the way shepherds had to look over the sheep in times like this, and if we can embrace the type of fervor that they had in times like this, in times like ours, we should find it easier to integrate and more preparatory work, trying to be ready for when this time comes. So let's take a look and see what we come up with. Verse 1. Therefore, I exhort the elders among you, as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. All right, interpret the instruction based primarily, or at least at first, on their present situation. What was the need of elders in their situation? Why were they so important?
Strength and leadership.
Okay. Why do you need that, Jonathan?
You've got to have that strength and that strong foundation of leadership, because otherwise the rest of the flock is going to see how the leadership acts in suffering. And if they're weak, well, you know, I can waver a little bit. I can kind of step back a little bit. But no, if the overseers and the shepherds are there and they're strong and they're continuing to feed the flock on how to defeat the suffering that's coming in and the trials that are coming in, they're all going to be able to stand firm.
That's a good point. Their examples emphasized in verse 3, their example and their shepherding and their leadership. It makes me think about churches that grow strong because of the preacher. And then when he's gone, they fall apart. Peter was the ultimate preacher, was he not? I mean, Peter's your preacher, your church is cool. But Peter died. He died about a year. He may have been dead by the time this letter got there. Peter would be a great Paul, a good preacher to have around. Timothy had that youthful exuberance. He died too. What goes on? The church and its eldership goes on. You see, preacher is a person. He lives and he dies, or he moves, or something happens. And eldership is an ongoing structure. And it interchanges people as time goes on. But it becomes the reason your church can face the challenges, the eldership. So proving to be an example is part of that. Now, I want to get back to this beginning idea, shepherding the flock of God. This is why we use the term shepherd, because it is a description of what they're doing. Now, to help us understand how they would do this during these troubled times, you have three not this but that's. So the first one you have is exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily. Now, I want you to think about their time. Okay? Their time is things are bad and they're getting worse. People are scared and they have kind of reason to be. That would be a time when you had a church with no elders where some men said, I don't want to do it. I wish I could just go run and hide, but under compulsion, I'll do it. That's not what we need. What an interesting idea. Even when you have to have people stand up, even then, it should not be under compulsion. So what do you think he means by not under compulsion, but voluntarily, under the context of their distress? What do you see there? What attitude are we looking for in these guys?
That they are willing to serve.
Okay, they're willing to serve. Yes, sir?
The first thing for an elder is to desire the office.
Okay.
So it ain't something that you just going to do, in other words, just out of compulsion. No more. You've got to desire and work yourself up to it. Nowadays, back then they appointed.
I agree with that. Desire to office. And I think we can temper that a little bit by verse 4. Everything is best understood through the chief shepherd. Everything. Shepherding is understood through the chief shepherd. I wouldn't say Jesus desired to die, but he desired to voluntarily do what it took to save people, right? He desired voluntarily. He did not come because somebody had to do it. He did not come because nobody else would do it or his hand got forced. He came voluntarily because that's what the people needed. That's leadership. Leadership knows that it's going to be hard, and they don't. That 1 Timothy 3, I think, sometimes gets misused. You've got to really want to do this. I don't know that you're ever going to do this with your hands when you're an elder. You're never going to sit there and go, oh, so great. But you understand its value, and you want to make a difference. That would be so key, because people who are forced into work, they're forced into the position. When they realize they might be the first to die from a Roman army, they resent their position. I don't even want to be here. I never even wanted to do this. They made me do it. That's not great leadership. That's not going to help anybody get anywhere. We need people who voluntarily do that. So you're going to see three of them. Not this, but that. And the first one I think is really clearly understood there because of the pressure that was coming. Yes, ma'am. That voluntary idea. Yes, ma'am.
About throughout the whole gospel and through giving, particularly, it talks about being a cheerful giver. But in all the service and all the things that you do, if you don't do it from the heart, then it's not good. It's rejected. So it all has to come through.
Yeah, voluntarily. That's right. The giving, I think, is a good parallel, good example. Someone back here. Yes, sir.
Much like husband, your father, your family, there's nothing you wouldn't do for them. Yeah. Sacrificial broken
blood. Yeah, nothing you wouldn't do. There's a love. All three of your comments come together. There has to be a love for the people, a genuine desire to see them succeed, and a mission for that. If it's under compulsion just because, well, we see that a lot. I mean, that happens. And when things are going fine, nobody notices maybe. But when things aren't going fine and the real work begins, it becomes really evident. Yes, sir.
All of our work and giving or whatever, it has to be free will. God has no, God doesn't want, and he doesn't force anybody to do something they don't want to do. It has to, like she was saying, it has to come from the heart. Okay. And if you do it out of compulsion, there's no benefit in it for you if you're doing it against your will.
Let me get one more comment, and then we'll move to our second piece. Yeah, Josh.
Where I used to work, had opportunity to participate in selecting different leaders in different groups. And there were basically three types. People who wanted the position because they thought that'd be cool to be over a group. There were people who didn't want it. And there were people who wanted to influence the outcome of what that group could do for the best benefit, for the best outcome. And invariably, we would wind up putting some from each of those positions because of distress. We'd say, well, we got to have somebody do it. And we'd put them in, and the outcome would be like you would expect. You'd have a person who would be in it for the position, and they just wanted the glory of it.
Yeah.
You'd have people who didn't want it, and their heart wasn't in it. And then you have people who truly just wanted to succeed, in whatever it was. That's just a secular example, but the same concept is there. A person's heart is to help the other brethren serve Jesus, stay in it when it's hard, and go to heaven, then you've got the right person involved.
I'll tell you what makes Josh's comments so on point. Do you see, and I'm reading from this New American Standard, maybe a slight variation, but the very first word in chapter 5 is therefore. You guys see that or something like that? In other words, this instruction to elders is connected to the idea at the end of chapter 4. And the idea at the end of chapter 4 is the outcome, right? It's the outcome. It's seeing Jesus. It's entrusting your souls to a faithful Creator. It's the judgment that's coming. Therefore, we need elders who get that, who, and I love the way he described it, they're there because there's an outcome. They want to see what can be produced. They're interested in souls getting to heaven. So part of that is it can't be under compulsion, but voluntarily, which you can see why they might have been, there might have been some compulsion based on their distress. The second one is, according to the will of God, of course, is connected to that, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness. Who has another version that says something other than sordid gain? Shameful gain? Okay, what else do we have?
Dishonest gain.
Yes. Filthy lucre. I'm going to be honest with you. When I'm mad at him, I call one of my sons that. Luke. Filthy lucre. That was bad. That's really bad. What does it mean? What is that? This not for this, but for that. What does that mean? Talking about leadership, shepherding, elders. What's the impetus of this? What's the point?
Out of it.
Okay. I would directly connect that. We already gave this away in Acts 20. It is more blessed to give than to receive. Acts 20. That's the whole thing about the Ephesus elders. More blessed for what you can offer than what you can get. You do get things, but it can't be the beginning. It has to be the second thing. The first thing is what you give, and then if you receive something, that's fine. I was talking to somebody about going to the Colonial Nursing Facility this morning, and I was mentioning on the way out, you know, we have had some people come to church here because we went over there and we encouraged them, but then I came right back and said, but it's not about the results. We're not doing it to get people to come to church here. We do it because it's the right thing to do. And if results come, they come. But the purpose has to be to do the good, not to receive the outcome. And elders have to be able to think that way. Now, what I find interesting is this idea, again, no matter what version you use, kind of looks like they might have gotten paid for what they did. That's another lesson. I'll let somebody preach it when I'm out of town. But I do think there is much authority for supporting shepherds financially to do their work. They're so much more important than the guy that you're staring at right now. Long term, so much more important. We need them focused on the work. But the point is this, if they think that this is about getting, based on what I've shown you back up there in the introduction, what's about to happen to these churches? What's coming? If it's not there yet, and our timing is right, and Peter's in Rome, probably detained, about to be killed upside down, and he sends this letter and he throws it to the east, what's the message of the letter? They're coming to you. If they're doing it to get something, they chose foolishly. Now, in modern-day application, because Brother Noble's right, there's all kind of modern-day application, we have a lot of peaceful times, and there are men who serve as local elders because we're so used to the way that politics work in America. And we're so used to the way that notoriety works, and there's this sense of saying, I'm an elder of the church there, and as if that, you know, is supposed to solicit some applause or something. And while we would never say it that way, there's this sense of, okay, I've accomplished something. I hope you see how false that whole dichotomy is, that whole design. The idea here is we're doing it with eagerness not with sordid gain, because we want to help the outcome. And when things get tough in a church, there's no fanfare. Of course, shepherding is a thankless job anyway. I mean, very rarely are people come. It's kind of like I sent out the email this week on Thursday. I was a day late on Friday. And I never get anybody respond. But I got two this week because I made two mistakes. People are like, you messed that up. You know, it's kind of the way it is with elders, right? Nobody comes to your office and says, I just want to meet with you guys and tell you you're doing a great job. It's tough. It's got to be about something else besides getting. It's got to be about these people need us. Yes, they come to the office and they have things to say. They need us. It's a big shift. And you know, when things get tough, that's when we can tell the big difference between great leadership and poor leadership. Third one. Yet not as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. Somebody give us an idea of what that's saying. There is authority there. It's kind of a not but construction because there is some lording. There is a little bit of authority involved, but not lording as an action term. What does this mean?
Lead by example.
Okay. Lead by example. Doesn't mean you won't tell people what they have to do at times. But your standard operating procedure is leading by example and expecting them to follow you. Read your Bible more often. Eldership reads their Bible more often. Make the right kind of sacrifices in your life. Shepherds make the right kind of sacrifices in their life. Dan?
My translation says domineering, not domineering it over them. It reminds me of, and you may have shown this in the past, but there's this image I see a lot where they show two different pictures. And it has Egyptian-like drawings, and it says this is the difference between leadership. And one is a man up on top of a massive load, and he's pointing forward as his subjects pull him and the load together.
Yeah.
And there's the one where he's in front with the men pulling the big load together.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Not domineering. Good point. And so that attitude is so important here. And to help with that, examples, and then verse 4 doesn't let you get far. Have you noticed that no matter where you are in this letter, you're not far from Jesus? It doesn't matter if you're being asked to give up things, suffer like Jesus suffered, chapter 4, verse 1. If you're being asked to do things, do like Jesus did. If you're being asked to go through difficult times, remember your Savior. Well, an eldership is not allowed to get very far from Jesus either. Because as soon as you get into three pretty challenging instructions, compulsion, not compulsion but voluntarily, not for sordid gain but with eagerness, and not domineering or lording, but just being examples, verse 4 brings you right back home. When the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. Eldership has to understand that there is a reward coming. There is, just like for the rest of us, there is. But it comes when the Lord gives it to us. In the meantime, we have a spirit of giving and sacrifice. And so these verses go right along with several others that we read. But as you know, based on their present issues, it was all going to come down to your leadership and how they help the flock get through it. And the truth is, Brother Noble's right, peace or challenge, that's still true. It's true of Lindell Church. We've got seven men serving us now, meeting together to talk about souls, trying to implement themselves into people's lives, bring people into their lives, structure things to help them grow. The qualities of this protect us now, and when we really, really need them, they're going to be there for us. And that's what this church was facing. There was a comment back in the back. Mr. Eugene.
I'd like to read a statement that I just wrote down. And that is, the bottom line is that elders must be qualified. They must be willing to serve on their own. And they should always know the Word of God and go by it and teach it and be able to teach it. And they must always live an example before men and before the brethren according to God's word.
And the church said,
Amen.
Yes, sir.
I want to go back to this willingly because this connotes to me, I'm going to say that, suggests to me, not that I know, that it implies that there must be an action by these elders. And when I go back and I look to see who this letter was written to, the very first verse in 1 Peter talks about, in my edition, it says, to the pilgrims of the dispersion, which means
means that there are people who are being spread out and moved around. And so you have an eldership who perhaps are getting people into their church that they don't know. They're coming from everywhere. And the reason I want to bring this up is because it's not unlike the Lindell Church. In the last year, we have seen a growth of 50 to 75 people. And so the eldership, I believe, has to be on their toes to, it's real easy to people that you know, people that have always been here. But then people come in from different places, and it requires an eldership to be willingly active to get to know those people, to learn about them, to lead them in the direction that they want this church to go. So I see that there's, you know, some similarities between their church and ours.
I do as well, and I would add one angle to that, and our time's about up, but that probably these elders of this church, however many there were, let's say there were 10 of them, they probably all didn't grow up in that town. They were the accumulation of a lot of new people coming to town too. You had new people coming in, serving as, I mean, at some point when they knew the church and they could be trusted as leadership, a lot of growth, a lot of mixing up of churches. That's a great point. Having that perspective on these reads of who they were and where they are, I think it just brings these passages to life in a profound and purposeful way. All right, here's what we're going to do. You guys didn't really think we're going to talk about elders and finish the whole chapter today, right? Okay, good. Here's what we'll do. I know we can finish chapter 5 on Wednesday. I'm confident of that. But we're going to change the gear just a little bit, and I want to set you up for this for Wednesday night. If you have any lingering comments about overseers and you want to bring that up or questions that you might have, feel free to do that. We're going to meet here Tuesday night at 7 this week, so just come and ask your questions then. You'll be alone. No, really, if you want to ask more questions about it, come Wednesday night, you can ask those questions. But I think I just want you to see, remember, this isn't a dissecting verse-by-verse study of 1 and 2 Peter. It's especially not going to be in 2 Peter because they're going to have about three classes to do 2 Peter. So it's going to be a little bit of a different take. But what I want you to see is there's the elders, they get about four verses, and then there's this message to younger men. And here's what I'm going to challenge you to do. As you're reading this over the next couple of days and preparing for Wednesday night, why does he go from, questions I have for you, why does he go from elders to younger men? Who are these younger men? Is it the church broken on the male side into two categories, elders and younger men? And why are they being noted? What's important about the message? Do you think it could be possible that there could be friction between younger men leading their families and the eldership leading all of their families? Could there be something needed? And I think the word humility is going to come up on Wednesday night quite a bit, actually. And I'm also interested, and you probably won't remember all these questions, but just read it and think about the overall text. But how many of these verses are for these men? I had a little trouble fixing that or kind of coming to fruition on that. So think about, is it just a verse or two for the young men? Or is there really a lot about what's going on in the rest of the chapter that's about these young family leaders? So we're going to talk about men on Wednesday night, and then we'll finish with some things there, okay? So you'll see more of this on Wednesday. Thanks for your attention.